Hello and welcome to the March 3rd, 2026 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to give a quick summary of the latest articles you'll find on annals.org. Let's get right to the new material. When the U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services dismantled the membership of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and the committee's rigorous methods for developing evidence-based vaccine recommendations, professional organizations began to collaborate to develop recommendations that are based on science and created by people with expertise in infectious diseases, vaccination, and public health. The American Academy of Pediatrics focused on childhood vaccination. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology focused on pregnant persons. The Infectious Disease Society of America focused on immunocompromised persons. And the American College of Physicians focused on non-pregnant, immunocompetent adults. New articles in Annals report the American College of Physicians' recommendations for respiratory syncytial virus and COVID vaccination, and the evidence reviews supporting the recommendations. Annually in the U.S., about 170,000 adults aged 50 or older are hospitalized, and 14,000 die due to RSV infection. Most adults infected by RSV have mild upper respiratory infections, but it can also cause life-threatening lower respiratory infection. Among adults, severe RSV infection is more likely in those aged 75 or older, living in a long-term care facility, or with comorbid disease. Based on evidence review published with the recommendations, the American College of Physicians recommends RSV vaccination for adults aged 75 or older and consideration of vaccination for persons aged 60 to 74 at increased risk for severe RSV. Unlike other respiratory virus vaccines that are administered annually, such as influenza, an RSV vaccine is currently administered only once, and the need for repeat vaccination is currently being studied. The ACP considered evidence on potential benefits, including reductions in mortality, severe disease, and hospitalization, as well as potential harms, such as Guillain-Barré syndrome. COVID-19 remains an important health problem with more than 20 million cases in the U.S. from October 2024 through September 2025, resulting in over 500,000 hospitalizations and 60,000 deaths. Adults aged 65 years and older, adults 18 to 64 with substantial comorbidity, such as asthma, cancer, cardiovascular disease, or other respiratory diseases, and current or former smokers at greater risk for severe COVID-19. Based on a review of recent evidence on COVID-19 vaccines that is published with the recommendations, the ACP encourages these individuals at increased risk, which account for over 90% of COVID-related hospitalizations, to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The studies reviewed included patients at varying risk for severe COVID-19 and varying personal history of COVID-19 infection and vaccination status. Evidence from the rapid review and epidemiologic data showed an association between adults age 18 or over who received an Omicron-adapted mRNA-based vaccine and a reduction in the risk for all-cause mortality and COVID-related hospitalizations compared with those who did not receive the vaccine. Pain with walking is a cause of impaired mobility and poor quality of life in persons with hip osteoarthritis. It has been hypothesized that certain types of shoes might lessen discomfort due to hip osteoarthritis due to walking. Researchers from the University of Melbourne in Australia set out to learn whether stable, supportive shoes could more effectively reduce hip pain than flat, flexible shoes in people with osteoarthritis of the hip. 120 adults with hip osteoarthritis recruited from the Greater Melbourne, Australia area were randomly assigned to receive one of the two shoe types and asked to wear their shoes for at least 6 hours per day for 6 months. The primary outcome was change in self-reported hip pain while walking. The study found no meaningful difference between the groups in hip pain improvement. However, it is important to note that it is possible that it was just having new shoes and not the type of new shoes that improved symptoms. The researchers note that future studies should include a group of patients who continued to wear their usual footwear. Diltiazem can interfere with how the body processes certain anticoagulants, and there has been concern that diltiazem might affect the risk of bleeding in patients on anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation. This is clinically important because patients with atrial fibrillation may receive diltiazem for rate control. Next is a large observational study of patients with AFib that found that those taking blood thinners, including apixaban or rivaroxaban, had a higher risk of serious bleeding when they were prescribed diltiazem for heart rate control compared with metoprolol. Physicians' work gives them more experience with death than other persons. Many physicians express a desire not to die in a hospital. To determine how often this frequently expressed desire is realized, researchers use the National Vital Statistics System to analyze data from more than 11 million deaths of people aged older than 30 years from 2020 to 2023. They aim to determine whether physicians are more likely than other adults to die in settings linked to better end-of-life experiences, like at home or in hospice. They compared death settings of physicians with those of nurses, other healthcare workers, lawyers, engineers, scientists, and the general population. They found that physicians were only modestly more likely to die at home or in hospice than other adults. This pattern was consistent across the six leading causes of death. The authors conclude that while doctors' medical expertise might influence end-of-life planning, other factors, including resources, caregiving support, or unexpected hospitalizations, likely play a larger role. The findings suggest that even with their deep familiarity with serious illness, doctors experience only modest advantages in achieving end-of-life care in the settings many people prefer. In response to new U.S. federally mandated breast density notification regulations, researchers funded by the National Cancer Institute aim to determine when supplemental breast MRI is most beneficial for women receiving standard breast cancer screening. They use breast cancer surveillance consortium data with three cancer intervention and surveillance modeling network breast cancer simulation models to compare clinical and economic population-level outcomes of digital breath tomosynthesis, a 3D mammogram, alone versus a 3D mammogram combined with MRI for women ages 40 and over at average to four times higher breast cancer risk levels. The results showed that while adding MRI to mammography provided modest additional benefit, it also led to more false positives, making the balance of benefit and harms unclear. However, when MRI was added for women with extremely dense breasts and at least double the average breast cancer risk, benefit began to overtake harm. The researchers conclude that supplemental MRI could be a reasonable option for high-risk women with dense breasts, especially if MRI costs and unnecessary biopsies can be reduced. Accurate and efficient identification of women at high risk remains challenging. Next is a randomized trial that evaluated the effectiveness of metformin or ursodeoxycholic acid compared to placebo on recovery from long COVID symptoms. Researchers from Seoul, Korea, randomly assigned 396 adults with persistent symptoms of fatigue following acute COVID infection to receive metformin, ursodeoxycholic acid, or placebo for 2 weeks between July 2024 and January 2025. After 8 weeks, recovery rates and symptom improvements were similar across all three groups, indicating neither drug helped patients recover faster or more completely than placebo. The authors concluded that while long COVID remains a major public health challenge, these medications do not appear to offer a solution to persistent sequela of COVID infection. Also new is a commentary addressing telemedical delivery of buprenorphine therapy for substance use disorder, and another on the primary care needs of people with sickle cell disease. Health and Human Services Secretary Kennedy has challenged the United States Preventive Services Task Force legitimacy and canceled its meetings, raising concern that the USPSTF might face a similar fate as the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. In a commentary by Dr. Robert Lawrence, the first chair of the USPSTF, and Dr. Stephen Wolf, its first scientific advisor, reflect on the task force's 40-year legacy from pioneering evidence-based medicine to securing insurance coverage for A- and B-rated preventive services under the Affordable Care Act. The authors describe how political interference could upend trusted clinical guidance and result in previously eliminated financial barriers to preventive health interventions. They emphasize that the USPSTF was born out of a need for recommendations based on evidence and not ideology or opinion. They warn that abandoning the task force's rigorous scientific standards will threaten not only preventive care access, but the broader infrastructure of evidence-based policy that has shaped U.S. public health for decades. That brings us to the end of this podcast. I hope you'll go to annals.org to read some of the articles I've mentioned here. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.